This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
After Nixon used the IRS to go after targets, there were laws created that made it very difficult. And there's only two political appointees in the entire IRS now in order to limit political meddling. So there's no way to tie this to the White House at all. This is sort of mid-level bureaucrats in the IRS doing this. And the more we learn about it, we learn that they went after liberal 501c4 groups as well, far fewer of them than Tea Party groups, but still several of them. So I don't see any kind of political vendetta or any kind of systematic effort to target conservative groups for the sake of targeting conservative groups. I see mid-level bureaucrats given almost no direction on how they're supposed to do their job in determining what's a legitimate political group and what's a social welfare group, and doing the best they can in a poor way, and then rightly getting in trouble for it. But this is much less sexy than I think the media is trying to make it.
There are many observers of this current controversy with the IRS who point to what they believe to be a more important scandal, and that's the IRS code itself in dire need of reform, along with our system of campaign money, which was, of course, exacerbated by the Supreme Court Citizens United decision. There are people who are concerned, and you wrote a column about this, that this will have a chilling effect on any future scrutiny of groups on the right, particularly, but maybe any political group, and that whatever these organizations are doing in the name of their 501c4 status may be untouchable. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is the real scandal here. The whole reason that this happened is because the IRS has never defined what makes you a social welfare group or what makes you a political group. That line desperately needs to be drawn. Now, with the IRS under so much scrutiny because of this, I think it's politically impossible. And, you know, every campaign finance expert that I speak to says the same thing begrudgingly, and members of Congress on Capitol Hill say the same thing. There's just so much political pressure on the IRS now that they're not going to be able to draw that line. And if they do, they're going to come under so much scrutiny that it's either going to be incredibly weak or vague or, possibly backtracked on. And, of course, Congress could pass the law, but that seems highly unlikely given that Republicans control the House and, you know, would probably use the filibuster to preserve the ability to spend anonymously in elections than they have in the past. Unfortunately, you know, the best hope for resolving this small but important bit of the broken campaign finance system was getting the IRS to take action. And now it seems like that's going to be taken off the table for some time, at least until the scandal blows over. And even then, you know, the memory will be so strong of the scandal. And you can count on conservatives jumping on whatever the IRS does because they're not going to like it. They like this having this option of spending, you know, massive amounts of money anonymously through elections. It's really unfortunate, but I don't see a way that we're going to, close this loophole and draw that line between political and social welfare groups anytime soon.
That was Alex Seitz-Wald, Salon.com's political reporter. Find links to Wald's recent articles covering the IRS controversy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Multi-billionaires Charles and David Koch make their money by exploiting fossil fuels. They funded all manner of conservative and right-wing political efforts and candidates. Now the brothers are setting their sights on buying some of the most influential newspapers in the country. The Kochs have expressed interest in the bankrupt Tribune Company, which is looking for a buyer for the 8 newspapers it owns: the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, the Baltimore Sun, the Hartford Courant, and 4 others in Florida, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. According to news reports, the Koch brothers are top contenders to make the purchase, which could be consummated in the next few months. But that outcome is being opposed by a coalition of media activists, environmentalists, and grassroots community groups. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy with Free Press, a media reform and pro-democracy organization that is one of several groups opposing a Koch brothers' takeover of the Tribune newspapers. Here he explains what's at stake in the Tribune deal and how people are coming together to try to stop the Kochs' media grab.
I think the Tribune Company is in a pretty dire circumstances. They went through a bankruptcy proceeding recently, and the majority shareholders are now looking at ways that they can hand off the parts of the company that they think are the least profitable. The Tribune Company, people might know, not only publishes newspapers, it has 8 newspapers in fairly significant cities around the country, but it also is in the business of television broadcasting, which is much more profitable. And so they want to carve off, to separate those 8 newspapers and sell them for anywhere, and I've heard the number between $600 and $700 million.
Do you know if other entities are also interested in buying the Tribune papers?
Well, we only know what we've read in several media reports. The LA Weekly and the New York Times have reported that the Kochs are at the top of a fairly short list of prospective buyers of the Tribune Company newspapers. And there have been there's been interest expressed by a number of parties. In some cases, parties have wanted to just purchase 1 or 2 of the newspapers. There's a possible coalition of investors in Los Angeles that are interested in buying the Los Angeles Times, for example. But it's in the interest of the Tribune Company to sell all 8 newspapers as a single package. And the only investor who has indicated, again, this is reporting to these news reports, the only investor who's indicated interest in all 8 papers are the Koch brothers through their company Koch Energy and Koch Enterprises.
Tim Carr, it's an interesting kind of coalition where you have some media activists and some political types who are opposed to a Koch buyout, and also a real grassroots element. You know, like there was a big demonstration of grassroots folks in Chicago who were saying that the Kochs taking over the Tribune would be really detrimental to their lives. Is that happening in other cities as well?
It has, and there have been recent protests in Los Angeles. There have been protests in Chicago. There is a national day of action that is scheduled to occur later this month on May 29th that will involve actions in cities across the country. While the Kochs are known for the specific brand of right-wing ideology, this is really about journalism. This is about what it is that a newspaper should represent for a community. And the problem that organizations like Free Press see with the Kochs is that they do have a track record of attacking journalism. They do have a track record of supporting organizations that have misled the public on key issues like the science of global warming, and that their intentions for owning these newspapers are not to better serve those communities, but to further spread some of this misinformation. And that's not good for journalism.
That was Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy with the media democracy group Free Press. For more information on growing opposition to the Koch brothers' takeover of the Tribune newspapers, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, the university for grown-ups, where it's never too late to earn a bachelor's or master's degree to achieve your dreams. Adults of all ages choose Merrill Hurst to gain knowledge from professors who practice what they teach. Now enrolling for fall terms. Information at merrillhurst.edu/KABU.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC. This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Wolves are making a comeback all across the western United States for a species that has been all but eradicated. Wolves have shown an amazing amount of resilience in the last decade. Even more remarkable, the wolf's ecological role as an apex carnivore is now being recognized as an important piece of the environmental puzzle, despite continued contention between the conservation, ranching, and hunting communities. This morning, we talk with wildlife tracker, photographer, and outdoor educator David Moskowitz, whose new book, Wolves in the Land of Salmon, documents the wild wolves' return to the Pacific Northwest. David, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hey, thanks.
And you just came... You just came back out of the field, I understand. You've been trekking wolves for the last 21 days or so?
I've been teaching wildlife tracking classes in the Southwest, and then actually I was in the North Cascades most recently with Outward Bound.
Well, you talk in your book about the role that wolves play symbolically to different cultures. And I wonder if we can start by talking about kind of the clash between the different symbolic roles of wolves in different cultures and how the way that a culture relates to wolves is maybe a reflection of that culture's values itself.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of research that's really looked at how wolves are portrayed and perceived in cultures around the world because, you know, wolves being a circumboreal species, there's been many different cultures that have interacted with them. And there's often been a reflection of how humans interact with the landscape scene and their relationship with wolves. So a classic one is cultures that are hunting-based tend to have a very kind of positive outlook on wolves and see them with reverence typically. And then cultures that tend to be pastoral or livestock or based typically have a much less favorable view of wolves. You know, obviously in the first category, wolves are often seen as a icon or symbol of, you know, of hunting prowess. And when you start having livestock, obviously they become a threat to your survival and sustenance from a traditional perspective. That's at least been the case.
Well, when I was growing up about a half a century ago in the eastern United States, and they're, of course, very far removed from the reality of wolves in the landscape, and something that I was, I guess, kind of relieved that there were no wolves where I lived, because wolves were a very frightening thing in the childhood literature that I grew up with. And I wonder where that came from. And it was interesting to me as I became more aware of wolves and the role that they played ecologically many years later that I developed maybe the other side of the coin, almost a unrealistic symbolic reference for wolves, but I think that I'm thinking how interesting it is that wolves. I mean, there's so much terminology in our language about wolves that's so negative. And what do you think some of the roots of that are?
Yeah, well, so a lot of that comes from historic European culture, and there were times when there were issues with wolves in Europe and Eurasia. Wolves carried rabies. And, of course, back before modern medicine, contracting rabies was absolutely fatal, and it could be a very terrifying experience. So I think that there are some, you know, stories from the distant past in Europe and Asia where probably humans' relationship with wolves is very different than what it is now, certainly very, very different than what it is now here in North America. And actually, research that has looked at the negative interactions between wolves and humans throughout the world over time concluded essentially that wolves are the least dangerous large carnivore in North America, at least. So, less dangerous than mountain lions or bears, certainly less dangerous than interactions with domestic dogs. And a lot of the literature from Europe, historical, you know, going back centuries, there's even some question as to whether some of the negative encounters that humans had with wolves might not have actually been with wolf-dog hybrids, things like that. So there is some historical fact in, you know, where people have this fear of wolves, but the modern reality of it is that they're a fairly benign presence on the landscape in regards to human safety, at least. So it's just interesting how those cultural stories perpetuate themselves over time.
Well, on the other side of the spectrum, I've just finished reading E. McAllister's book, following the last wild wolves. And he writes about, actually, I was inspired to read that book by reading your section about the rainforest wolves.
Yeah.
And I just had the book lying around for 2 years. I was supposed to do an interview with Ian, and it never happened, but now it's going to happen because of my fascination with wolves has been really rekindled. But in reading that book, it was one of the things that really gripped me was he's describing these wolf packs that den in what basically are the foundations of old Indian villages. And he thinks that that shows that there used to be a much closer symbiotic relationship between wolves and people, particularly on the west, on the Pacific coast of North America, than it's probably possible for us from Euro-American backgrounds to be able to fathom.
Yeah, you know, I think that's definitely true. From a biological perspective, actually, humans and wolves fill a similar niche. We're both large, adaptable carnivores on the landscape, and we share many resources, and we share, you know, preferences for habitat as well. So, and this is true in the interior of the Pacific Northwest. It's true on the coast. You know, on the coast, wolves focus on feeding on salmon in many places, and of course, humans as well. You know, humans didn't evolve as fishermen. You know, we evolved, you know, probably scavenging large carcasses out in the you know, savannas in Africa, and wolves similarly evolved, you know, to consume large ungulates and things like that. But you put both wolves and humans in a landscape where there's lots of fish, and we figure out how to access that resource, and because of that, all of a sudden we have a shared habitat again, and the same